You're listening to the UFO Talker Podcast. Come with us as we explore UFOs from the past and the present. With insightful discussions, interviews, and reviews, we will add our voice to the mysteries that have been seen in our skies and oceans for all of human history. Now, here's our host, Michael Ryan.
Welcome, everybody, to the podcast. This is Season 2, Episode 32, and I'm coming to you from Studio 7H here in Ontario, Canada.
And this is Christine Scott coming to you live from Studio 9H in the beautiful Warehouse District in Regina, Saskatchewan.
Well, it's a better day already because Christine's here.
Woo, in the house.
And we have to add in, you're not really live.
No.
This isn't really live, this show. It's live to tape, kind of. But
yeah. I'm representing in the 306, as the kids say.
Yes. And I don't know why I'm doing this, but I'll give right now just a little tiny glimpse behind the curtain, you know, like in the Wizard of Oz.
Pay no attention.
So this morning, I shouldn't even say this morning, but it is morning when we're doing this, but I have to tell people that we've taped a few different segments this morning, and I'm not going to say who it was, but somebody forgot to press the record button. You know, we're not going to say who that guy was, but these things happen.
Perhaps a man in black was involved.
That's what I'm going with. So, Christine, on today's show, we have Irish ufologist Chris Gaffney.
Yeah, I'm really interested.
I know. And he is going to talk about a lot of EU stuff that no one in North America knows about or we don't hear about very often. It's very interesting. And he is a very interesting guy. So I'm looking forward to it.
Me too.
And something else we want to talk about is an interesting story you had about a police, something the police and April Fools.
Yeah.
We just had a few weeks ago.
Yeah. Now, this is really odd because when I used to write for Cracked, I wrote an article about horrible April Fool's Day pranks. And one thing, you know, the editors added to the article is that cops really hate April Fool's Day.
Yes.
Because a lot of the items I included in the article were horrible pranks where the cops had to become involved that turned out to be not funny at all. But here I read the other day, police in Lower Pottsgrove Township, which is around the Delaware Valley, for April Fool's Day actually orchestrated a special alert about UFO sightings in the area, including photos.
Oh, they had a lot of time on their hands.
They did, and I read this twice, and I'm going, boy, if I was still writing for Cracked, this would be a pretty big thing. Because, yeah, as they say, cops hate April Fool's Day. I mean, they do not participate, you know, if they do, it's something really mild. But for the cops to orchestrate a phony UFO sighting with photos?
I know.
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal.
Just in general, I think, you know, like really when you think of these April Fool's things, it's not like when we were kids. It seems different now because when you look on Facebook, and I forget what the figure is, it's worrisome, but 30% or 40% of people get their news from Facebook. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's scary, but anyways.
Yeah.
That April Fool's Day was filled with pranks on that Facebook. Yeah. And so many of the pages that I read, there's lots of people that believe the news that was the April Fool's joke.
Yes.
And I thought, well, how many of them haven't come back for the guy to say this was not real? And now they're telling their friend and their friend. And I'm going, wow, it seems like one big disinformation campaign now that Facebook is just it's a psyop.
Yes.
One large, you know, intelligence warfare network or something. But yeah, I'm not sure about that story. I think that's crossing the line a bit. You know, like, well, should the police be doing this? I don't know. Like,
well, especially after writing my Cracked article, where basically they were all cautionary tales about how mad the cops were that people pulled, I mean, horrible pranks I don't even want to go into on air. And then reading this and going, wow, the cops are doing it themselves.
Well, it sounds like it was a very small,
small
police
scale.
Force.
But can you imagine the amount of people who might have thought it was real?
I know. Yeah. Scary. Yeah. And you have also some information on our very good friend, Representative Tim Burchett.
I almost consider him a friend of the show.
I know. But I feel bad for him because really he's been thrown onto the forgotten politician from yesteryear pile. Because he seems to have gone nowhere with all of his enthusiasm for discovering what UFOs are.
But, you know, his enthusiasm hasn't flagged because he was interviewed by Russ Coulthart on News Nation April 2nd. And he basically announced more UFO hearings coming. And I mean, that, I think that sounds optimistic on his part. I think, you know, his enthusiasm isn't flagging. Basically what he's saying, not necessarily that they're going to happen, but he says there needs to be more hearings on the subject. He wants future hearings on the subject.
I know. I have a mixed feeling about Tim Burchett. So I do believe he does have a genuine interest in it. But I also believe that he sees all the likes he was getting. Mm-hmm. And so I think those likes are going down because now his star is kind of fading in the UFO world. Because he actually said, I don't know if it was that interview or something recently, he actually said, I don't think we're ever going to find out what they are because it doesn't seem like the people in power want us to know. No. So I thought it sounded like he'd given up.
Well, this sounded really gung-ho, and he even talked about, I guess, Kirkpatrick, the head of the Alderman Anomaly Resolution Office at the Pentagon, resigned, but not before saying the office was continuing to try to pursue the truth. And Coulthart and Burchett thought Colonel Carl Nell, former chief of the UAP task force, should replace him. So they're still looking to the future. They're still talking like this is a possibility. But, you know, is this false optimism?
Yes.
Yeah. And Burchett also, because he does present himself and he's very open about being a devout Christian, also said his belief in possible extraterrestrial activity is not at odds with his faith. He has no problem believing there are mentions of extraterrestrials in the Bible. And like a lot of people mentions the first chapter of Ezekiel in the Old Testament. So he does present himself as having a personal interest.
Now there was also, this just happened recently the other day, is a Senator Mike Rounds. Mm-hmm. And he's in the Senate, whereas Burchett is in the House of Representatives. And he was being interviewed by Matt Laszlo, and they were talking about UFOs. And he asked Senator Rounds, he said, do you think that what David Grush is talking about, can things like that be kept secret? And he actually said in a resigned kind of way, he said, you know what, really anything can be kept secret and away from Congress. It's quite possible. And I thought, boy, is that ever telling? Because now they just, it almost seems like they've given up in a way, where they just resigned that there are elements that do what they want and there's no way to rein them in. And I didn't used to think that before, but now I'm leaning more that way that I've talked to enough people that would know that, you could hide stuff and there is stuff hidden away from inquiring minds.
Well, listen, they even make a joke in the Independence Day movie, you know, in the mid-90s, where they present, Area 51 isn't real. And Judd Hirsch's character said, what, do you think the Pentagon really spends $12 on hammers? Or something like that. Yeah. You know, that it's hidden in the budget. We don't even know, you know.
And then also kind of some bad news we have to report is Recently, in the last several shows, we were mentioning UFO expos and conferences and that kind of thing. So one of them, the Hangar 18 conference, which was going to be held at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, that has been canceled.
Oh, no!
That has been canceled. Now, I won't go into it here because Ray Zemanski has done a whole video on it. It's over an hour. So if you want to hear all the fine details, you can look that up on YouTube. But unfortunately, yes, that was canceled.
It would be really fun.
Yes, yes, especially being on the base at, the base, right? Patterson Air Force Base. But now, Christine, it's that part of the segment where we give a shout out to the small towns or cities where we have listeners. And this week, we are shouting out Red Deer, Alberta.
Yes.
Which is
population, as of 2017, 103,588 people. But that was 2017, so that could have changed.
And also, as everyone knows, that I always mention, I always look at several videos of whatever town we give the shout out to. And I have to say, this is the biggest little town I have ever looked at. Like, if you saw photos from here, you would think it was a town of many times the population of what it is, because there's lots of big buildings and there's a lot of infrastructure. They have a lot of museums and restaurants. And I think, wow, they've done well for just 100,000 or so people.
And it's if you're in Alberta, it's halfway between Calgary and Edmonton. Yeah, when you say museums, it's got the Red Deer Museum and Art Gallery. And very important, it's the home to the Alberta Sports Hall of Fame and Museum, which is a pretty big deal for Alberta. It was incorporated as a city in 1913. It was, loosely organized homesteads and trading posts.
And it has the Red Deer River runs almost right through the middle of town.
And I would personally like to give a shout out to the used bookstore, our colleagues in Red Deer, Alberta. It's called Nearly New Books, 4936 53rd Avenue, number 1. It started in Comox, and then Vic and Jean, who started it, moved to Red Deer, and it's now run by Diana and Cliff. And I've heard from people coming in the bookstore, excellent used bookstore. So please, if you're in Red Deer, visit our colleagues there.
And, of course, we cannot give a shout-out with mentioning a restaurant and a bakery. And the restaurant that I have picked is called the 111 Grill. And, of course, anyone who knows Alberta is known for its beef. That's where all the Canadian beef and oil comes from, Alberta. And they have a couple of things on the menu. It looks like a wonderful place. And they have something. It's red pepper spinach dip. Served on oven-baked bread. Oh, the picture. I could almost eat the picture when I saw it. But and then they have lots of steak on there. So they have prime bites is what they call it, little sirloin steak bits. And they lightly coat them in Parmesan aioli. I think we need to turn this into a cooking show because I just... And, of course, once you've eaten there, you have to go to this place called the Donut Mill. Now, I have seen a lot of pictures of bakeries. I've been in a lot of bakeries. And the pictures they have of their donuts and the way they talk, I'm thinking, okay, if you're a donut aficionado, you have to go to the Donut Mill in Red Deer, Alberta, because it truly looks amazing. And they have a donut special of the month. You can only get it in certain months. So there's two or three I have to shout out here because they look just amazing. One is the hazelnut cream donut, their strawberry Bismarck donut, and April is their blueberry delight donut. And trust me, it looks it looks very good. And at any time of the year, you can get their apple pie donut. Oh, yum. Yes, it's sad that... I need donuts every now and again. So.
Now, how close are you to a good donut place where you live right now?
Yeah, not that close, unfortunately. There's some posers.
Yeah.
That are pretending to be great donut shops. And I've gone in and had a donut and I thought, yeah, this is not that good.
See, I can walk to the end of my block, turn left, and go to the Everyday Kitchen in Regina, which has the most amazing sourdough donuts.
Wow.
Oh, they're amazing. And if you sign up for the newsletter, just like you're saying, you know, I've been known to sit in the bookstore and just look at the pictures of their donuts online. Going, they're just down the street from me.
And I think this is as good a time as any that if you would like your donut shop featured on UFO Talker, we're not against you sending us donuts.
No.
We just want to throw that out there right now.
Yeah, we can talk about food and UFOs forever.
I know, and it's a great combination, isn't it? Donuts and UFOs. I feel anyways.
And we'll be right back after this message.
The date was December 30th, 1966. It was a clear, moonlit night as Canadian Pacific Flight 421 flew at 31,000 feet through the inky darkness just off the Peruvian coast. The DC-8 was on its way to Mexico City. Captain Robert Milbank had put the aircraft on autopilot. Co-pilot J.D. Dahl looked down at his watch. It was 3 a.m. Most of the passengers were asleep. It was very quiet on the aircraft. He was thinking about the great time he and his wife had at their home in White Rock, British Columbia, last New Year's Eve. Captain Milbank, who had been looking at something off the left side, asked Dahl to take a look at this. The pilot and co-pilot could see two extremely bright white lights. Within a minute, the two white lights seemed to be moving towards their aircraft. Finally, the object placed itself off their left wing and paced their DC-8. Co-pilot J.D. Dahl thought the object was roughly the same size as their DC-8 and about 500 feet away. They could see a row of dimmer, yellow-white lights between the two white lights. They called for other crew members to take a look. Some thought they could make out the shape of a craft, like a saucer shape. After 7 minutes, the lights moved towards the tail of the DC-8, and finally, the object took off at tremendous speed. When asked about the sighting later, Captain Robert Milbank said, "I must say that in my 26 years of flying, including wartime, I have never seen anything like this before, and I'm convinced that UFOs are not a dream in somebody's head." What did the crew of Flight 421 see in the early morning hours of December 30th, 1966? In his final report, co-pilot J.D. Dahl said, "I was a non-believer before, but I was satisfied that we'd been intercepted by something not of this earth, and I've been in the interception business for 4 years."
My next guest is Chris Gaffney. Chris has been interested in UFOs since the 70s when he became an investigator for the Irish UFO Research Center. He is also a private pilot. In 2020, he created NHI Disclosure, and in 2022, he also created Project Morrigan. Chris is also the Deputy National Representative of ICER. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here. And as you know, this is my first interview, so I'm sure you'll be patient with me. I've been very much behind the scenes for the last couple of years, and so I thought, well, hey, I like your soil, so here we are, Mike.
And also, as everyone is, it's pretty obvious to everyone who's listening right now, Chris is from Ireland.
Yeah.
So there is a bit of an accent. So if there is any part during the interview where I'm not sure of an acronym or something, I'll have Chris spell it out.
No problem. And just before we get started, as you mentioned, I'm a deputy representative for ICER, the International Coalition for Extraterrestrial Research. And there is a joke at meetings that I need to come with subtitles, and that's even for the people who speak English. So it's a joke, and I'm sure you're familiar with Victor. Victor is the Canadian representative for ICER. We joke about my accent, so it's no problem if you don't understand me. I'll slow down, and I will repeat myself.
Okay. So I guess the this is always the question I ask of most people, because I find it fascinating, is when did you get interested in UFOs? Like, what ignited your path?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as I get older, and we're from a similar vintage, I find there's an awful lot of people from around our age group that have had an interest all their life. I really don't know when. As a child, maybe growing up watching Doctor Who and growing up in Dublin near Dublin Airport, I just always had a fascination. And strange enough, when I was being educated in school as a young boy, we were encouraged to ask questions. And I remember a Christian brother speaking about, at the time, their flying saucers and saying, these are interesting. And that always it ignited a little flame in me. So I've always had a passion and an interest in the subject matter. So when I was growing up quite young, you may remember this, and some of your listeners, that there's no internet, there's hardly any telephones, and if you had an interest in something, you'd buy a book, and at the back of the book, there'd be contact information or details. And from that, I joined BUFORA, which is a British UFO Research Association. Shortly afterwards, I was approached by some people north of the border, I think it was John Hine and Miles Johnson, and I set up what would have been BUFORA Ireland, in the south, and that would have been the early 70s. And it took off from there, and ever since I've had an interest. Probably took a little bit of a hiatus, wasn't active for maybe 20 or 30 years, but the last, say, 7 or 8 years, I've just thrown myself back in at this time. I just think, you know, there's so much happening, and I think everybody should be involved. Anybody with a little interest in the subject matter, you know, should try and play a part. So that's why I'm here. That's where I came from, and I've decades of research, and I suppose imagination, just wonder about the whole subject matter, Mike.
It's funny you mentioned, you know, what it was like when we were much younger. So younger listeners to the podcast who have always had internet and cell phones and all those things, boy, I wonder if, you know, when they think back, it must sound like the Stone Age, that, you know, how did we exist without cell phones and computers and no internet? But there was a time where that's all it was.
I don't want to go off topic, but maybe we pondered things more. Maybe we taught things through a little bit more, and information wasn't so instant. So, not being an old fogey here, but maybe that's how I kind of see it. And sometimes information is just too quick now, and we don't get time to digest the information. So maybe, you know, you have a point there. Maybe those old ways, yeah, there's a lot to be said for them.
And Chris, in Ireland, in the modern era, when did UFOs really first started popping up in the news and in newspapers?
They've never really gone away. So modern era, where would you consider that, Mike, from the last maybe 20 years or 15
probably
years?
Probably the late 40s.
Ah, yes, sorry, I understand now. Thank you very much. Okay, they've always been there. They never have not been. Like, Ireland's kind of sort of, I suppose, a land of legends and mythology. And so if we sort of rewind a little bit from the what we consider to be UFO, UAP, we go back a little bit as flying saucer, and we go back before that. There was always, let's put it this way, the other in Ireland, the mystical. So, and as long as we've had sort of, if we want to go back to the 50s when they were flying saucers, we've always had cases. There's always been sightings in Ireland of anomalous phenomena, as we call it now. So in the modern era, which we may get onto later on when we're talking a little bit later, there's a couple of interesting cases I have there that we'll go over where some documentation I've discovered will point out that there was actually an interest at government level in Ireland going back to the 50s. So maybe that'll be something we'll touch a bit later. So yes, there's always been an interest in UFOs and UAP in Ireland, wherever we would have called it then.
Do you have, are there a few classic cases from the past that that I'm probably going to say people in North America and probably a great part of the other part of the world that haven't heard of? Do you have any classic Irish cases, UFO cases?
Obviously, when we spoke a few weeks ago, Mike, and I was thinking, God, what cases would I pull out for Mike? And I try to, rather than just stories, I try to find something that's documented, you know, rather than with a little bit of evidence. So there's a fascinating case from, it's an aircraft, it's a Viscount, that was, I think it was coming into Dublin Airport in 1962 and encountered an object that closed in. I think a Viscount would have an airspeed of, I think, around 300 knots. The pilots reckon, and actually this is on, if anybody wants to watch this, it's on, I have it over on unexplained.ie. It's an excellent YouTube channel, so I suggest your listeners check it out, okay? And the pilots have been interviewed, and the attitude of the interviewer and the pilots is so much better than it will be now. The pilots described to have a closing speed of an object at roughly 1,000 miles an hour. So they reckon the speed of the object was 700 miles an hour. I think it was about 15,000 feet. I'm not sure the altitude now offhand. There was no wings, no visible means of propulsion. And this was reported by two pilots coming into Dublin, I believe, on a Viscount in 1962. I believe the name of the aircraft was St. Colum Keel. Ireland would have named this Aer Lingus, which is a national carrier, always had its aircraft named after Saint, an Irish name. So the Colum Keel is spotted by two pilots, a pilot and obviously first officer of a Viscount in 1962. And that's reported in the press. It's actually, you can see the pilots being interviewed on, but you check it out, unexplained.ie. And I like that case. I like that case because there's no sneering as before X-Files music would be played when the pilots be getting interviewed. So I find that, I like that case. That's one of my favorites.
And it is funny that when you watch some of these older films of pilots and different people from the 50s and 60s being interviewed, it's just a lot more serious. Like, as you mentioned now, whenever a news network or a news TV station covers it, they always play the X-Files music and they always have some little joke that they go into and they they don't take it very seriously.
But the irony is, around the time the Viscount has been flown, there would be very little automation, you know. So the lives of the people in that aircraft were in the hands of that pilot, you know. But yet, now we laugh at pilots. Obviously we wouldn't, but people would take it with a grain of salt what a pilot would say, would report. But yet they'd be getting in an aircraft with somebody similarly trained and traveling around the world and putting their lives in the hands of this, of an aviator. So I just, you're right. I just find it, when I hear those X-Files music, I just want to scream. And I'm sure anybody who has any knowledge of the subject matter just wants to scream. It's so, come on, grow up. It's about time, you know, the media grew up to a certain extent. There's actually, there's another fascinating case, and I have to give credit to Carol Nally and Dermot Butler. So anybody who has an interest in, I suppose, the subject matter in Ireland, there's three fantastic books written by Carol Nally and Dermot Butler. The first is Conspiracy of Silence. I think they wrote that in about 2006. And that is the definitive history of ufology in Ireland. Well documented, well researched. I've gotten to know the two. We don't call them guys in Ireland, okay? We call them lads. And I'm from the north side of Dublin, so it's definitely lads. They're not guys, okay? If anybody heard me call them guys and they know I'm from Ireland, they'll be in trouble. They're two fantastic researchers. They've written Conspiracy of Silence, States of Denial, and their State of Denial, Denial, my Dublin accent, not Denial the River. Okay, it's not that Denial, okay? You don't have to edit that, okay? State of Denial. And then the last one is Circle of the Seat, which is about sheep mutilations not far from just north of the border in Ireland. That's a fascinating book as well. This is a great case because it's about a Boeing, it's an Aer Lingus 737-400 series. I think the call sign was Echo India Brava X-Ray Delta. And it was inbound to Dublin on, I think it was the 4th of January 2004. We'll talk about the area maybe in a few minutes where this sighting took place, because there's some more to this area north of Dublin, County Mead. I'll explain a little more in a few moments about this. But the long story short, the aircraft was approached to runway, I think it was 10, was being followed behind by a British Midlands Airbus, I think it was a 330, and they're coming at an altitude of about 3,000 feet. That's above mean sea level. Their airspeed would have been approximately 250 knots. As the 737 approached, I think it was the Slane area, the Airbus crew, this would be the aircraft coming in behind the Aer Lingus 737, noticed what he thought was strobe flashing lights from a field on the ground. They then noticed what he thought was a triangular-shaped object take off. Now, this is from the crew of the aircraft, the British Midlands Airbus that was behind the Aer Lingus craft. They noticed the 737 being circled by a triangular object. The 737 experienced a power drain, and the aircraft behind noticed a glow around to 737, okay? At this stage, the Aer Lingus 737 asks air traffic control for a vector of its heading to avoid the object. They're given a vector of degrees. Now, this is very unusual, because anybody in any knowledge of information is when somebody's coming into land, you do not vector them, of course, because, you know, you're interfering with other aircraft coming behind, and you're also interfering with the schedule of the aircraft taking off. The 737 captain filed a near miss with Dublin Air Traffic Control. At that stage, the UFO or object angled off to the port side, and the wake turbulence of the object shook the aircraft violently. The systems on the aircraft showed an outside temperature of 164 degrees as the UFO scorched through the air. The whole incident lasted, I believe, about, say, 15 seconds and was witnessed by the British Midlands air crew. They also themselves had a similar incident with the aircraft later on. Now, here's what I find really interesting. When the aircraft landed, okay, when the 737 landed, it could not raise its air brakes. And apparently there was damage done to the leading edge of the wing. The aircraft was then told to go to stand 132. So anybody familiar with an airport, especially Dublin Airport and other, Aer Lingus is a national carrier. So they will have priority when their aircraft lands. So they will go, and you won't get a ladder off an Aer Lingus aircraft. You go straight to the terminal. There'll be a jetty put out, and you walk on. So for the aircraft to be taken to a stand away from where it normally would is very unusual. It's unprecedented. I've got some contacts in Dublin Airport because I grew beside it, and they said, stand 1, 2, 3, Chris. There's something very strange going on there. So there's apparently physical damage caused to that aircraft. This is documented, I think, the pilot review by Colin Early and Dermot Butler. If people want to know more about this encounter, I suggest you check out their book, Conspiracy of Silence. I think it's still out there. You can still get that book. So it's a fascinating case. Now, when I learned about this and I spoke to Colin and Dermot, I said, listen, lads, is it okay if I do a follow-up? So what I'm trying to do at the moment is I'm trying to get my hands on the service record of the aircraft. Shortly after the incident, it was sold, we believe, to the Middle East. And then it was sold on again. Now, there's a reasonable chance if the aircraft was 2004, that's 20 years ago now, that's been decommissioned. But I believe that the service record has to be kept for 7 years, even after an aircraft is decommissioned. So what we're trying to know is I'm trying to get my hands on the service record that will remain with the aircraft. Obviously, if it's sold on, the maintenance book stays with the aircraft. It's a part of the legal documents. So that's a fascinating case. You know, an awful lot of people don't know about that case there. I just think that's a great Irish case.
I was not, to be honest, I wasn't familiar with this case. And the one thing that is really unusual is I kind of racked my brain a bit. I can't think of another encounter with aircraft where it was that close to the UFO where they felt turbulence. And also where they could measure the temperature, like 164 Celsius.
4 degrees.
That's very hot.
That is hot. There's also, I believe, and just the later on that evening, and I just want to kind of keep this as short as we can, another Airbus coming in, an A330-200 series, with about, I think it was 213 people aboard, had a similar experience. Their wind shear detection or device in the aircraft started to scream. The aircraft pitched down, and obviously they landed safely, and they also filed a near miss for air traffic control. So this was two aircraft on the same evening. This happened to. Now, the interesting thing about this, and it's where this took place, is in an area north of Dublin. And for anybody who's an interest in Irish history, they will know that's very close to a place called Newgrange. Newgrange has a Neolithic tomb there that predates the pyramids. And on the winter solstice, the sun shines right through and lights up, I think it's a wall in the burial ground, or a wall in the burial chamber in Newgrange. So it's more of a coincidence that that happened near Boyne. And also, where it took place is near where, I'm not sure if anybody's familiar with the history of Ireland and so forth, but it's where the Battle of the Boyne took place. Now, in Irish history, there's probably isn't a more important battle, and probably, as you want to say, for Britain as well, because that was William and James. They were an uncle and nephew, I should say, and that's the side of which bloodline would rule the British monarchy to this day. And that took place in the same area. There's a wonderful book, and it's called Ireland, Land of the Pharaohs. It's by Andrew Parr, And he goes into history of Ireland and why this part of the country is special and why the battle point took place there and why Prince William crossed the Boyne on his charger, which is supposed to represent Horus, the sun god, crossing the Nile, because the footprint of the Boyne and Newgrange is very similar to the Gaza Plateau. I know I'm going off subject here, but I cannot mention this area north of Dublin without bringing that into it. I just find this is where, if we're going to try and get a head around what this phenomenon is, we've got to really sort of really take everything into consideration. So that's just a little side note to this case here. And I know Carl and Dermot are familiar with it.
The Lingus Plain, that, yeah. And also I'm trying to rack my brain because I can't think of another instance where the craft was damaged. There was actual physical damage.
Either can I. We don't get to be our age, Mike, without making a few complex. So I brought this report to a friend of mine, obviously I'll not mention his name, who serves as aircraft, who's worked for Boeing and would have worked in Aer Lingus. He was trying to get me the service records from there. He couldn't get them, and he suggested to me that I go to get the service, the maintenance book that stays with the aircraft. Obviously, if the repairs are carried out by Aer Lingus in Dublin, they would have a copy of the records. Also, would a copy of stay with the aircraft. And I spoke to him about the damage, what was reported to be done to the aircraft, and he agreed that that's possible. If there was major turbulence in front of the aircraft, that could happen. And this gentleman, I'll not mention his name, it's his job to sign off aircraft and when they're maintained, especially Boeing's. And he is very, very familiar with the 400 series 737. So he told me, he said, Chris, yes, that damage that was done to that aircraft is consistent to what the report that Dermot and Carl put together. They also spoke to the pilot. So I cannot think of another case, but we get the service record. You know, that's a smoking gun.
I think, because there are some people who say, well, to them, then this proves that this object, or at least this object, was made on Earth. But then, you know, I've talked to several people where they say, governments or United States or whoever would have this craft, they're not really testing it out near passenger planes. Because, you know, there could be death involved and all kinds of things. So, yeah, just they don't do that. Okay. So,
no, and this makes me laugh, Mike, because obviously we'll have conversations with people and they go, oh, it's, you know, it's top secret tech, it's this, that, and the other. And I'm not saying that an awful lot of UAP are not. Of course they are. Of course we've been seeing stuff. However, top secret says top secret until such a time it's deployed and it's needed. You're certainly not going to be testing some top secret tech on the final Dublin airport. It's just ludicrous. Oh, my God. You know? And if somebody crashes into it, you know, it's just crazy. And it's the same thing with people are talking about, you know, oh, it's American tech that we're seeing, oh, you know, that's the limits and so forth and all that. No, they keep it secret till they need it. That's the whole idea, you know. Keep secret tech is secret, you know. Oh, no, that's why they have test ranges, you know. Come on. So that just doesn't add up to me. But yes, I agree. You're 100% right there, Mike. They will certainly not be testing terrestrial technology. And I'm not saying this is non-terrestrial for one second. I'm not saying that. However, if the powers to be are testing it, they're certainly going to be testing it close to Dublin, the biggest city in Ireland. You know, not a hope. You know, so I agree 100% there, Mike. You're on the money there, my friend.
A few episodes ago, we had on a Canadian major, Harold Scarab, and he had a very long career in the Canadian military, and he was aware of stuff that, you know, the public doesn't see. And there are several experimental aircraft that governments had been testing. And the other thing we tend to forget is he said, when they're new aircraft, they crash a lot. And he gave an example of one craft that they were testing. It had crashed 30 times. So if something is experimental and they're testing it, yeah, definitely they're not... they're not on the final approach to Dublin.
Yes,
well, let's test that out there.
Yes. You know, I know, I think there's normally, when Dublin Airport's busy, you can maybe say 90-second separation between aircraft coming in. So it's a busy, corridor, you know, to the main airport in Ireland. So, you know, and especially it'd be a January, there'll be people coming back from holiday, so every aircraft will be full. So, yeah, no way. Yes, I'm not buying that. That just doesn't make sense.
Chris, it's interesting, and you pointed this out to me, and I was not aware of it, that there is a woman in Ireland, Betty Myler, who is kind of like the Irish Anne Druffel, and she had been around for a long time and was very important. She's no longer with us, but very important to Irish ufology. I wonder if you can tell us a bit about her.
We cannot talk about Irish ufology without mentioning Betty. Betty is an incredible age. She has passed away in 2010, and she was probably an inspiration and driving force to so many people in Ireland regarding UAP. She arranged numerous conferences in Galway and in Boyle and throughout the country. If I am correct, Betty, her interest came in UAP. She's a very respected businesswoman as well. So, you know, she's a forceful lady. So I cannot praise her enough, the influence she's had. And she is a legend in Irish ufology. And that's not a word I would use. There's countless interviews on television, radio with Betty. And this is going back to the 90s and the noughties, where she speaks so much sense. You know, she was really an incredible woman. If I'm correct, she got interested. She lived, and this is, we spoke when we had her chat maybe for weeks ago. There's no such thing as a coincidence, especially in this subject matter. Betty lived near Boyle, which is County Roscommon, and I think it was in around 1996 or 1997, there was an alleged crash. Okay, I use the word alleged. Again, anybody interested in this, check it. And I'm not getting paid by Karen Lally and Dermot Butler to plug their work, okay? You should have them on supplier, I'm certain not. It's just, if anybody wants to know more about what I'm talking about, a lot of this is their research. I've got to give them a hat off to the two guys, okay? So the Curlew Mountains are near Boyle, and I think it's about 1996-97, there's an alleged crash there. Some people said it was a van crashed into another van or something like that, but apparently there was an awful lot of a cleanup operation by people in strange uniforms. So the word on the street around Boyle was, well, this was actually a UFO that crashed, and a crash retrieval team came in and cleaned up the scene. And I think that sparked Betty's imagination. And from there, she went on to form the Irish UFO Society. She arranged conferences throughout the country. She had great speakers over. Actually, I think Gary was over there. Gary Heffernan and Craig spoke at one of her conferences. I think Gary was over there a few times. You've had Gary on your show as well, an incredible researcher. So that's, you know, I cannot praise Betty enough. She passed away in 2010. And interesting, my colleague in ICER, Dr. Eamon Answorth, is also from Boyle. He's from Dublin, but he lives in Boyle because Boyle is considered to be around there. It's a term I don't like using. I don't like the term hotspot. It's apparently an awful of activity in that part of the country and around lakes there. And I think Barry Fitzgerald, not the actor, who's another phenomenal Irish researcher, he's an awful researcher in her area as well. So Betty, can't praise her enough. She's closely connected again with, say, Carol and Dermot, and she's a legend in Irish ufology. So hats off to Betty. I cannot praise the lady enough.
And when did she start, roughly, looking into UFOs?
If I'm correct, and I only met Betty once, going back years ago, it would have been, and I may be correcting this, was after she heard a case in 97 where the alleged crash, not far from her, in the Curlew Mountains near Boyle, County Roscommon, which is kind of northwest of Ireland. So I believe she got involved around that time, and once she got involved, she got involved. That was Betty. She's a very respected businesswoman. She, you know, she got things done. She arranged and apparently self-funded numerous conferences here in Ireland.
It's fun. Funny when you had, in our pre-interview a few weeks ago, when you had mentioned her, I had never heard of her before, and which goes to show you when, you know, every day you think you know everything and every day you're proven wrong. So that's kind of fun.
No, well, I, in all honesty, Mike, I'd like being proven wrong.
Yes,
and I'm just going to briefly touch on ICER for a second. And the wonderful thing about ICER is, and I'm sure you know who ICER are, we've representatives, I think it's 32 countries now, I think it's 54, between deputies and representatives and all over the world, five continents. And I'll be at meetings with some people I can only describe as, you know, as heroes of mine, and we will all see things slightly different, which is good, because it's not an echo chamber.
Yes.
You know, and we will learn so much. And if I talk to people on this subject matter who have the same opinion as me, which changes all the time, by the way, then I don't learn. We're learning every day. But Betty is an incredible woman. You know, she passed it. And an interesting thing as well is, I find it fascinating the amount of females are involved. Females in Ireland are very, very powerful in this subject matter. And I find that interesting.
Well, it's funny that you mention that, because Betty Myler has some videos on YouTube, which you can watch.
Yes.
And I'll probably put links in my show notes to that. But she really reminded me of Anne Druffel. And I have had other conversations with other people interested in UFOs. I don't think it's my imagination, there's a disproportionate amount of females involved in ufology that in just regular life in corporations and companies, there weren't as many. I mean, now it's different. Yeah. These days are different, but if you go way back into like Anne Druffel's time and that kind of thing, there is a lot of women involved in ufology. Yeah. And it's like you've mentioned, it seems to be at a much higher percentage than other categories
and powerful
in the world.
Women.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. And powerful women, which we may put a link in. This ties into Project Morrigan, but I know we're going in our sequence now, but we'll when we talk about Project Morrigan, I'll explain a little bit more about the powerful women. Okay, so I know we're skipping ahead of ourselves here, but maybe you can edit this bit out. But there's no such thing, Mike, as a coincidence, you know. So that's where we are there. So Betty, legend, along with Dr. Eamon Ansborough and Carolyn Dern, we've been privileged in Ireland to have such incredible researchers, you know, over the years. And it's just strange that for some reason you found me. There's so many other people you could have found, Mike. Okay.
Something else that we spoke of, and it put it on the radar for me again. I mean, so much of what you've told me I wasn't aware of, but can you discuss what the Flying Saucer Working Party was in Ireland?
Okay, what happened was, as we spoke a few weeks ago, I decided I'd do some digging and see, well, okay, most of my work has been in the last maybe, say, 15, 20 years to find out what's been going on in Ireland. So I decided, you asked for older cases, so I decided to do a little bit of digging. And I came across a few interesting things. And I started off by going into one of the first ufologists in Ireland was Desmond Leslie. Okay, and for those of a certain generation, they will know where Castle Leslie is. It's in Glasslough, County Monaghan. Now, for anybody with an interest in music, that's where Paul McCartney's family come from, Glasslough. So you know the way. Well, that's, I think, what's it, John Lennon famously once said, if it wasn't for the famine, the Beatles would be Irish. It's funny. So Castle Leslie is, I suppose, it's a stately home, the family Leslies. They are very quirky, very interesting, and they have a huge connection with the subject matter. So I don't want to go off topic here too much. Okay, one of the first books written about flying saucers was in 1950 in Ireland, was by Desmond Leslie from the Leslie family. He wrote, I think it was George Adamski, he wrote that book, Flying Saucer, I think it landed. So that's a connection that we have in Ireland going back. So while researching Desmond Leslie, I came across, and this, I showed this to a journalist friend of mine, Niall Federer, and I can't praise Niall enough. He is responsible now for incredible articles in the Irish media over the last few years and a few world first. So Niall is an incredible journalist. I can't praise him enough. So I showed this to him yesterday. We had a meeting, and I was trying to find around the 50s or that type of time, was there any documents in Ireland regarding the would-be flying saucers then? And I found a confidential report from Joseph D. Brennan. And Joseph Brennan was the Irish ambassador to the United States in Washington at the time. And it was to Brennan Joseph D. Brennan, and it was to Frederick H. Boland. I'm not sure if I sent this to you. And this is a confidential report from the National Archives, from the Department of Foreign Affairs in Ireland. The gentleman he sent it to was the first Irish ambassador to the UK. He was the first Irish UN ambassador, and he was the first Irish member of the UN General Assembly. So we're talking about fairly high-hitting diplomats here. And this is a document. I'll try to read it out here, okay? And I've got my glasses on, okay? This is confidential report from Joseph D. Brennan to Frederick H. Boland, 15th of June, 1950. So this is, you know, Irish diplomats. And the department is no doubt, which would be the Irish department, aware of many published reports in regard to flying objects which have been nicknamed flying saucers. Nicknamed, actually says named, okay? Recently, there is a publication titled The Flying Saucer Reel, a copy of which I enclose, which purports to give the story of these airborne objects. The book speaks for itself. The conclusions of the order are that these objects are propelled from another planet. The book is having immense sales in the United States. So this is where it gets interesting. Okay? My newspaper friends tell me that the book is factual and the reference given are well authenticated. Two releases issued by the Department of Defense relative to the subject are attached. Now, I'm not sure what they were. So that's obviously further evidence with this document. Yesterday, I had luncheon with Mr. Wilburn of UP, and he told me weeks ago that an American airline plane landing at Washington Airport was circled three times by one of these manifestations. The pilot radioed a tower to Washington Airport and was asked to give them a radar fix on the object, but the tower was unable to do so. The newspapers carried out reports in the first edition, but that was dropped in every edition afterwards. Okay, so the newspapers obviously were censored. Okay, we're nearly finished, Mike, so just bear with me here. The recent announcement that the State Department proposes to form a scientific branch for the exchange of information between all countries, which has no bearing on security, is supposed to have something to do with flying saucers. So what they're doing, we're talking about cooperation internationally with countries that are not considered to be a threat. The Secretary of State announced that he was going to recruit top flight scientists to head of the scientific branch of the State Department. And it goes on, maybe in a couple of paragraphs, but that's between probably two of our leading diplomats in the 50s. So I just find that fascinating. Yeah, and this is a confidential report from the National Archives that I discovered.
It's kind of an important document because, you know, there's been so much speculation about who is looking into what around the world. And
yes,
a lot of times governments around the world, especially back then, they kind of said they would tell the public, oh, we're not interested, or we're not looking into this, or this kind of thing. But there's all these documents, including what you've just read, where it kind of shows a different story, that there was some kind of network of Western governments that definitely did keep track of this information.
Yes. So, exactly. I did some more research on a little follow-up, and this is work in progress, Mike, and when I get to the end of this, but I discovered, and I'm not 100% certain, but that the Irish government then set up a flying saucer working party to investigate flying saucers in the 50s. I've been in touch with the National Archives, and the folks there are very, very helpful, and they're going to try and get me more documents. But that's what I'm working at the moment. Now, it's not to be confused. If I am correct, I think Winston Churchill, after the Second World War, set up the Flying Saucer Working Party in the UK. Not to be confused with that. So it's fair to assume that if the UK set up a Flying Saucer Working Party, so would Ireland, because we're neighbours and we would tend to follow them. So I find that fascinating. The information I have, I can't confirm, but it did say that Ireland carried out research from the 50s into the early 60s, and it was inconclusive. So that's what happened there. So I when I get more documents, I'll share them with you, Mike. But that's what the Flying Saucer Working Party is, and that's a document to have between two of Ireland's leading diplomats from the 50s discussing the reality of flying saucers. Strange, I find that when myself and yourself and other researchers do our work, we tend to go for UAP, UFO, anomalous phenomena. We don't mention flying saucer, okay? I might have to start using that term now. And although I sort of parked it, as you did, I'm sure, if we're going to start go back to historical documents and we're using FOIs, maybe it's not a bad idea if we include that term.
Well, it's funny, Stanton Friedman, until his death, he used the term flying saucer, like whenever he went, spoke, or anything. That's the term that he stuck with.
Yes, fascinating.
It's interesting.
And rightly so.
It's interesting that definitely when you follow up on this, we're going to have you back on the show, because I think this document that you just read from is kind of pretty important, because whereas in the States they had Project Blue Book, which was a public, everyone knew about it.
Yes.
So the document you're reading from, so that, from what I'm gathering, was not public in Ireland. Like the Irish public didn't know about this group.
No. This is a confidential report, and I stumbled across this when I was doing some research from the National Archives. I just maybe just a bit of pot luck, you know, the way sometimes you just get lucky. And as you've explained to me before, how your research, sometimes, you know, you get lucky. Nothing changed. And I'm sure you'll have the same thought process here. Every shot you don't take, you miss.
That's
so
right.
I will, if you don't take a shot and people are, I'm not going to try this, well, try it, because you've nothing to lose. You know, and that's my philosophy here. So an awful lot of stuff I've stumbled across is because I've put something out there, something comes back and it'll lead to something else. And so that's I showed this to Noel Fredler yesterday. We had a meeting because he's working on an article for Irish newspapers on Project Morrigan. So he was blown away with it, and he said, I'm going to show this to the editors. You know, we can do articles on this. This, I didn't know it. And we got a few pictures of the two gentlemen involved. You can imagine their 1950s are very, very diplomatic looking in their black and white photographs. Yeah. And both their CVs are impressive. The two gentlemen here, they are serious diplomats. You know, these are not just interns, or what they wouldn't have interns then, but these are serious operators, these two gentlemen are. So that's fascinating. So that's what led me on to the Flying Saucer Working Party here in Ireland. It's a work in progress that I've only sort of stumbled upon. So that's sort of what I'm doing at the moment. So hopefully I'll have more of you soon.
Well, definitely when you have more on that, I definitely want to have you back on the show, because that is super fascinating. Well, one thing I have to tell my listeners is that Chris Gaffney, he is a very busy ufologist. He has a lot of things going on, and one of them is you created NHI Disclosure. I wonder if you could tell my listeners what that is.
Okay, NHO Disclosure is a little initiative I came up with a couple of years ago, and there are tens and tens of thousands of people like you and I. You know, you were doing something like, because you've got your podcast. And I thought, like, what can I do to make a difference? You know, I'm a big fan of JFK, and he said one man can make a difference and every man should try. Now, I know that's politically not correct. Now, it should be one person. Okay, so we can, just for the sake, but that's what he said back there in 1961. So I decided to start do some digging and investigation via FOIs and so forth to see what we know in Ireland and what we know in the European Union about UAP, what's been going on, have they been investigating them, is there a policy to it? And that's basically where NHI came from. So it started off about 4 years ago, and it was with the help, I've got some help from some wonderful people. I think it was UAP Media UK. And they created a document that they sent to the Ministry of Defence, or it could be in the Ministry of Defence in the UK. So I asked for permission to use that document, and I tweaked it, and I made it suitable for Ireland and the European Union. So I sent it to everyone. I did what Ross Coulthard said. I got lots of stamps, I got some good paper, and I sent a document to everyone. And basically, it's a briefing document. Now, my version has been called the Coveney briefing document, because Simon Coveney at the time was the Irish Minister for Defence. So it's kind of nicknamed the Coveney briefing document. So I sent it to everyone just to see what would happen. And I got a few, thank you for correspondence back from ministers and that type of thing. So my next move was, okay, I'm going to FOI all these people and all these government departments and EU departments and see, have you on your documents? I think you can guess where this is going, okay?
Yes.
Have you on your documents on UAP? And guess what? They all came back and said no. And I went, ha ha, gotcha. I know you do. because I sent it to you. Okay, so then I could go, okay, just like that sort of gave me the legitimacy to go a little bit further. So armed with knowing you weren't going to tell the truth, I got a little bit more forceful. I learned a little bit more about FOI legislation, and I decided to do a little bit more digging. And yes, I can say with a fair degree of certainty that there is more knowledge in the EU and Ireland about UAP and the subject matter than what they will pretend. And just from NHI disclosure, probably one that, say, most of your listeners will not know, Ireland is part of the European Union. And one of the top military people in the European Union was a General Claudio Graziano. He was the head of the European Union Military Committee. So he's probably one of the top military men in Europe. So I sent him some of my stuff, and I got a letter back. And I don't have it in front of me now, but if any of your listeners want it, it's out there online. I can get you a copy. And I just want to put this in context. This is a top military man in Europe, or one of them. And he's saying in a letter to me, yes, Chris, UAPs are critical events that affect the aerial safety of Europe. All EU countries have reporting mechanisms in place, and he will bring the subject matter up with the chiefs of defence of all EU countries. And that, to me, was disclosure. Mm. And that was from a top... And that came from NHI disclosure, sending out information, getting it back. I've also managed to get quite a few Irish politicians on the record as well. Maybe we'll touch some of them maybe later on when we're talking about one of the other cases we're talking about. But that's basically what Project Morrigan is. I also got on the record was a gentleman called Joseph Borrell. Joseph Borrell is the head of the European Defence Agency. He is also vice president of the European Commission. The European Commission is... I'm not sure if you're listening, familiar. The European Commission is a top bureaucracy. It wouldn't be bureaucracy. They are the government of Europe, really, the Commission. There's the Parliament, then there's the Council, European Parliament, the European Council, and the European Commission. So the European Commission sort of trumps everything. So that's what happened there. I got a letter off him acknowledging that the EU was aware of the situation that created a task force in the United States, and that he doesn't have jurisdiction under Article 42 of the Treaty of Europe to create structures in Europe to investigate UAP. So that's from the Vice President of the European Commission and the head of the European Defence Agency. So that's what NHI disclosure about. There's lots and lots and lots more that I could speak for hours about on cases in Ireland for FOIs. I actually got a dope, I'm sure if some of you listeners may have seen Dope Sick, was it, about the OxyContin, that terrible case in America. There was a Netflix... From FOIs between the Department of Foreign Affairs and Ireland Department of Defence, I'd say, I pissed off somebody because I got a drop of documents that's going to take about a year to go through of information. And in it, I'm sure there's some really good nuggets, but I'll have to go through them all. I'd say they just said, we'll keep this chap busy here. He's annoying us all. So that's what NHI disclosure yes. is, briefly. It's my initiative. And there's quite a few. Maybe, if you want to, maybe we'll have a little look here. There might be another one or two cases that we got from NHI disclosure also as part of my FOI work, NHI disclosure. And this is a biggie as well, okay? This, I'd say, very few listeners know about this. Okay? The European Union has a population, if I am correct, of in around 440 million people. United States, 330 million people. Okay, so after China, I suppose the EU is the biggest, I suppose, I won't say country, biggest union in the world. Ursula von der Leyen, who was the president of the European Commission, the president of Europe, okay, and I found this through FOIs and NHI disclosure, made a statement in 2022 saying that UAPs are a mystery that have puzzled mankind for decades, and that the EU should now, the 27 EU states should start investigating them. So this is the leader of Europe,
yes.
Ursula von der Leyen. So this is, most people won't be aware of this, you know, this type of thing. That's kind of what NHI disclosure is about. There's lots more that we could talk about maybe later on if you wish to do so, if you have enough time. But that's in brief. NHI disclosure is an initiative where as a normal person with knowledge of local politics, players in politics and so forth, can go out, request information, be clever, and try to make a difference. So that in a nutshell is what NHL disclosure is. So that's ongoing. I have files in front of me here from practically everybody, from the President of Ireland to our Taoiseachs, which are Prime Ministers, the Vice Prime Ministers and so forth, and Ministers for Defence and the Attorney General. And what I do as well, your listeners may get this. If I send some documents, briefing documents to the government in Ireland, and I'll fill them in on what's happening. Just last week, I got one from our Taoiseach. It was from our Vice Taoiseach, which is our Tánaiste, and that's our Vice PM. These are our Gaelic words. So Tánaiste is a Vice Prime Minister. So Micheál Martin, he's the head of Fianna Fáil, which is probably the biggest party in the world. Oh, not the biggest party, sorry. You can edit that out, the biggest party in Ireland, okay? The political party, definitely not the biggest party in the world. Okay, you get your system that one, Mike. And it's just, I notified him about Inspector General said about Grulch, Dave Grulch. So I got an email just confirming he got that information. So that's what the kind of stuff I've got going on here. I send a copy of everything to the Attorney General. I will normally get a letter from the Attorney General of Ireland.
Yeah.
Yes. As we know, the role of the Attorney General is to advise the state on matters of law and constitution. It's nothing got to do. That's their role. However, once I get an acknowledgement from the Attorney General, that means that the state solicitor, their solicitor, cannot deny, as this goes where we think it will go, Mike, they can no longer deny that they have the information because I've sent it to them and their own solicitor has acknowledged getting it. Okay? So that's something I do as well, which is kind of a useful tool. So that in a nutshell is what NHI disclosure is about. I've dozens of letters from practically everyone in Ireland, getting them on the record about UAP and what they know and what they don't know. And they contradict each other. And I've cut them out so many times. And I could write a book on the whole thing. And it's ongoing. So that's where it would be proper NHI disclosure.
Is there a website for
it? No. And this is, I'm old school. I got in, and this is why, as I explained, this is my first interview. I've never given an interview before because I'm very, very much a behind-the-scenes type of person. If anybody's interested in any of my stuff, if they reach out to you or maybe you can give my email or something, I'll give them a summary of what I've got, and anybody's welcome to my information. Maybe I've had quite a few dozen FOIs with the European Union, so they're on Google, and they'll find some interesting stuff there. On Google, if you go to Google and just go FOI EU Chris Gaffney, it'll all come up there. I think it's probably 15 in there where there's some fascinating information from FOI to get off the European Union. They're published on an EU website, so they're up there. All my FOIs are from UAP, so people may find out of interest because there's quite a few of them.
I want to talk about now something else that you started which we mentioned at the very top of the show is Project Morrigan. And if you could tell my listeners, what is that exactly?
Okay, Project Morrigan. For those who don't know, Morrigan, and this is where we're going back to what we spoke a few moments ago about female energy and powerful female. Morrigan was a Celtic goddess. She's a warrior. So I thought, well, if I'm going to start a project to try and get some information about UAP, or, let's call it after an Irish goddess, a warrior, okay? Yeah. So that's where Morrigan came from. Incidentally, the Morrigan was considered to be three, and there's supposed to be three sisters. Fascinating Irish mythology for anybody who's interested. Check out Morrigan. So in brief, I was thinking, okay, how can I get some information out and make a case for a scientific study of UAP? Okay, so the whole thought process behind Project Morrigan was, we can now say since the task force report came out that UAP are real. That's no longer a question. The question is, what are they? And what they are doing is they are showing tremendous amount of energy. The propulsion systems are off the chart. So it's clear to say that somebody somewhere has a holy grail of aeronautical technology / propulsion systems. Okay, and that deserves scientific study, especially at a time when we're facing, climate change and energy crisis globally. So the world, we're facing mass extinction events, unless we can have alternative energy. At the same time, UAP are demonstrating that energy. So what I decided to do was create Project Morrigan, and that is proposals to the House of Euroctus, which is the House of Parliament in Ireland, promoting that there should be a scientific academic study of UAP, with the results being used to help solve the climate crisis. Okay, so that is a nutshell of Project Morrigan is. So I created it and I sent it off to Irish parliamentary committees. In November 2022, the Irish Oireachtas Committee on Petitions accepted Project Morrigan as a legitimate case. Okay, in doing so, they're the first government or parliamentary committee, to the best of my knowledge, in the world, to acknowledge that the scientific study of UAP could be a possible solution to the global energy crisis. So that is what Project Morrigan is about.
And it that's what, and that is, you came up with that.
Yes, well, I created Project Morrigan. I have a copy here in front of me. That's been sent. It's been covered by the Irish Times, the Irish Independent. And it's got a little bit of traction over here. I think it even got it's got a bit of notice, but not as much as I'd like. It was discussed at several Oireachtas being parliamentary committees over the last year or two. I'm waiting for an opportunity to present it in person. It was discussed February this year, and I decided just to give them some more information. Okay, so we don't know what the modus operandi of UAP are. We just don't. But we do know it's off the chart.
Yes.
You know, I think that's fair. We take what the tick that does. We just have to listen to what Gary Nolan said and Kevin Knut said, you know, at the Salt Foundation. They're wonderful, wonderful talks with those two gentlemen. So I wanted to make a little bit stronger case with Morrigan. So I decided, I got an academic friend of mine, and I discussed, what pair is UAP? And we don't know. However, the most economical vehicle we have, to the best of our knowledge at the moment, would be a Falcon X. And if there's any scientists out there, this is our science project, okay? This what I'm saying now is just I'm making a case here, okay? So basically, we calculated what the propulsion system was, what the energy would be for Falcon X launch, and converted that so we could say this much energy from one of these launches can power 3,000 Dublin homes for 1 week, okay? We know this exists now, because UAPs are popping down, you know, up and down from the atmosphere all the time, or Tic Tacs are. That's not a question. Why are we not looking into this? So that is what one of the aspects of Project Morrigan is. It's a case that we know this exists. Now, I know UAP are not propelled by fossil fuels. You and I both know that, okay? However, all we have at the moment is fossil fuels. So this is what Project Morrigan is, a scientific study of UAP, with any breakthroughs going for the benefit of humanity and mankind, not for some secret project and not for the vested interests of some military group. No, that's what Project Morrigan is. It was accepted by an Oireachtas committee, parliamentary committee, and I am pushing with you. It's also with the United Nations. I haven't got anything back from them. And it's also been discussed by the European Parliament. So that's what Project Morrigan is. It's my little baby.
Well, it's interesting because I have spoken to several people. And something I'm looking into, and hopefully we'll have a show on it in the future, is in North America, you know, UFOs seen by NORAD radar. And the thing is, I have talked to radar operators who have tracked UFOs going in our atmosphere, going 20,000 miles per hour. And not only is that fantastic, but that the object stops on a dime and then reverses into a different direction. And so you don't have to talk to too many scientists to realize that there is nobody and nothing on earth that has invented anything like that, because it would just be physically impossible to stop an object going 20,000 miles an hour, stop it on a dime. There is nothing, not even close to what humans have made that could do that. So it has to be something, you know.
And like, you're 100% right, Mike. And what I find fascinating is every day you turn on the television, every day you look, there's the climate crisis, energy crisis. I don't know how much you're paying for, we call it petrol or diesel here. I'm sure it's gasoline over there. It's 180 for a gallon, it's not like for the litre of for diesel now here in Ireland. Everyone, we're being hit by carbon taxes, we're being hit by these levies. The planet is being destroyed. You know, we're trying to stick up these windmills everywhere to generate electricity. And we can say now 100% certainty, Mike, there are objects flying around globally that are showing propulsion systems that are off the charts. And why are we not looking into this? And it's about time we had an adult conversation, and politicians and science had an adult conversation about this. Let's look into this. And there's one thing I learned. I had a great Christian brother, which was, they were teachers when I was young. And he said, all science, Chris, is provisional. All science is. So for someone to say, okay, that scientifically is impossible. No, it's not. Do your science. You know, change the science. We have the evidence. Let's investigate this. And that's what this is about. That's what Morrigan is about. Is about let's investigate this. Let's put this out. Let's put it on the school curriculum. Let's encourage every university. Here in Ireland, we are spending millions and millions and millions on cycle names and projects, and I'm sure they're all very, very good. And at the same time, we should be investigating these. Every university, every college, every school in the world should have this as a priority. What is powering these, or whatever they are? And if we go in with an unbiased attitude, like, we don't know, some of it could very well be a natural phenomenon we don't understand. Some of it could be hidden tech. Well, if it's China, Russia, or America, I made a case to the Department of Foreign Affairs here in Ireland, because we had a seat in the United Nations Security Council a few years ago. And I'm saying, well, why we have our seat on the United Nations Security Council, why do you not make a case? Because I think Russia, China, and the United States are permanent members. Why do we not ask them, are you hiding some tech? You know, and obviously it fell upon deaf ears because of cognitive bias. But that was what I put to our Minister for Foreign Affairs, and he just refused to ask the question. Mm. So that's what Morrigan is about. As you can tell, I'm a little passionate about it. So, yes. Yeah. So we see. So, and I went off one of my rants. Sorry, I was told. I have it right here, Chris. Okay, you're going to appreciate this, Mike, because I have speak slowly because I'm from Dublin. I speak fast and don't rant. So, okay. That's what I have written here above my little screen, Mike. So that's what Morrigan is, and it's ongoing. I am as. Morrigan and NHI Disclosure, they can't overlap. And initially, I'm working on is in Ireland here, we have elections coming up this year, and we've also got European elections. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get on, I suppose, get to ask politicians, what is their policy on UAP? Do they have a policy on the reality of UAP? And if they do not have a policy, why do they not have a policy? So I'm working on that here in Ireland, that we're going to be asking all the politicians, you're aware of the reality of UAP, it's no longer a question. You know, what your thoughts on it? Are you willing to investigate this? So that's something I'm trying to politicize as regards. And I think it's somewhere we should be going. Anybody who's any elections, well, you're my elected representative. Are you aware of UAP? No, well, you should be. You know, that's another sort of little sidebar from NHI Disclosure I'm working on.
There's something else I want to ask you about, and it is about the an email. You sent an email, or the Irish Vice Prime Minister sent the email, and it was about the UAP data.
Okay, what happened was, basically, as part of NHI Disclosure, I've been chasing up on who knows what and when they know it, and I've been a bit of a pain in the ass, to be honest, but having said that, I'm getting decent results. So I have an email from Michael Martin, who's the Irish Taoiseach. Okay, that is our Deputy Prime Minister. And he states in his email that NATO member states share UAP data. Ireland is not a member of NATO. We do not. But that is from a sitting Minister of Defence from an EU country saying that NATO, EU countries share UAP data. And that is, you know, that itself, I believe, is worthy of, you know, follow-up, and why isn't he coming more on this, and why are normal journalists, you know, not chasing up on this subject matter?
So
you know, that's from Micheál Martin.
So what you just said, I don't think that is known. I don't think very few people know that.
Actually, here's another one that I didn't put in this that you may find interesting, okay? And when I do what I do, I try to have a little bit of fun. Okay, and we must, because I know the world is serious, but we have to have a little bit of sense of humor. So I had a thought there, like, because my little group is NHI Disclosure, and there's a reasonable chance that there is an NHI engaging the human race, I wrote to the Irish Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, and I asked her, what is the legal status of an NHI in Ireland? If I call loss, harm, or injury to an NHI, will I be bound by the law? Or if an NHI caused loss, harm, or injury to me, will they be prosecuted under the laws of Ireland, okay? And I got an interesting reply. And basically said, it is the lack of, what was she said, of jurisdiction rather than a lack of concern that allows me to comment on your question. So, in other words, our Minister for Justice has concern about the legal status of an NHI in Ireland. So I thought that was interesting as well. I have that in an email from Helen McEntee.
I know. I'm sure she looks forward to your next email.
Oh, she, actually she has, well, now I'm looking forward to it because, and I know we didn't talk about this in our pre-interview chat, okay, but one of my latest initiatives with NHI disclosures, I've pulled up some international treaties on why Ireland should be bound to investigate UAP. And there's quite a few of them, and I'll forward them to you later on, maybe, Mike, okay? So under this, there's aviation treaties. There's a lot of international treaties that do not mandate Ireland to investigate UAP, but certainly oblige us to investigate UAP to ensure the safety of our skies. Now, I am not for 1 second saying that UAP is a threat, but they are a potential hazard. So that is being discussed. That is with the Minister for Justice at the moment. It's also with the Irish Oireachtas Committee on Justice. Oireachtas being parliamentary committee, it's with them for their perusal and review. We also brought up, while I'm talking about NHI, we had, I got the Schumer legislation, I'm sure you saw it, the Slew Schumer proposal.
Yes.
That actually didn't go through. I got that discussed by the Irish Oireachtas Committee, Parliamentary Committee on Defence. September last year, I got that to them. So that's no. This is the type of stuff that nobody knows is going on here in Ireland. So we have an awful lot of stuff going on. So one of my jobs is to bring it to the attention of government and parliamentary committee. So I got a letter saying, yes, we acknowledge, we discussed this. So they can no longer say they don't know about it, Mike. And that's one of my missions.
So it really sounds like you need a website because you've got so much information.
I barely scratched the surface, Mike, and that's being honest with you here.
Something else that I want to get to before we run out of time is the group that has just been formed not long ago, and that's the UK, I don't know if I have the an acronym correct, but it's the UK Pilots.
Yep, UKPRU, UK Pilots Reporting UAP. Okay, I live in Ireland. I'm not in the UK. Okay, let's get there. That's my little. You're living in Ireland. What do you mean? You're, no. Okay, and I'm sure you know because you've got Irish blood. You've got Cork blood. And good God, if Cork people thought I'm from Dublin. I'm saying from the UK. I'd be lynched. Okay. Okay, I'm kidding. Those days are long gone. Gary Heslin is a colleague of mine in Iceland, and so is Dave Holden. UK Pilots Reporting UAP is Gary's brainchild, and it's a fantastic idea, a fantastic concept. He set up a website for UK pilots or pilots transiting the UK or in UK airspace to report encounters with UAP. This also covers air traffic controllers, etc., or anybody in the aviation industry that has anything, because there has been nowhere to report UAP. And because Ireland is adjacent to the UK, we share airspace, obviously. Most aircraft transiting from the United States or, say, from North America, or even we'll go through Irish airspace, we'll go through Shannon airspace. So, therefore, it was only logical that we had an Irish representative. So, Gary asked me, would I be interested? And he's aware of my work. So, I said, yes. To work at Gary Heslin, you better believe it. You know, so we're very, very much in the early stages. The website is up and running. There's Dave Holden, Alan Foster, you're the members, and obviously Gary. So, it's early stages yet, but what we're trying to do is, we want a platform. We want somewhere. If you're a pilot, you've seen something, you want to report it. This is where you report it. So that's what that's about. And there is this little, I suppose, people don't realise, and I have quite a few friends who fly with airlines, and they've explained, like, they are discouraged to report UAP encounters. And one of the reasons is, if they've seen something, they land their aircraft, they go to report something, they could be 3 or 4 hours in a room reporting this. They may miss the return flight. So you may have 150 passengers there sitting in a terminal while you're in talking about an encounter. And that's going to play havoc with schedules. And then maybe say for a long haul flight, you've got a pilot. He's landed, say, we say Aruba, okay, somewhere nice, okay? And he's got 2 days off in Aruba. Would he spend one of those days in a sweaty room reporting a European encounter? Or will he go out and enjoy himself? So this is an aspect that people don't consider sometimes, well, pilots don't report UAP. So that's what UK Toilet Report and UAP. It's basically a platform. It's a website that's been set up for pilots and people involved in the aviation industry from Ireland to UK and so forth who have encounters or want to report UAP.
I know it sounds like a fantastic organization, and it has a website, so I will...
Yes, Gary has the website, yes.
I will...
Yes. Okay, course, Barney, sorry,
I'll
go ahead.
I'll put a link to the website in the show notes.
Yes.
Something else I want to talk about is we have a clip from the air traffic controllers and the pilots, and you have looked into this a bit, but first I want to play the clip, so we'll play that now.
Okay, sir, there's nothing showing on either primary or secondary.
Okay, it was moving so fast, in fact, you can no longer see it, but yes, thank you.
990. 5x5, thank you. Alongside you?
Yes. Get to come up on our left-hand side and then rapidly veer to the north. We saw bright light and then it just disappeared at a very high speed. We were just wondering. We didn't think it was a likely collision course. We're just wondering what that could have been.
Meteor or another object making some kind of re-entry. Appeared to be multiple objects following the same sort of trajectory. Very bright where we were.
Okay, that's copied. And is there a direction it was going in or anything? That's right, it's copied. Thank you.
The Virgin 7-6 also saw that in our 11 o'clock position, two bright lights.
Roger, that's copy, thank you.
Glad it wasn't just me?
No, very interesting, that one.
Say again? Say thank you.
Virgin 7-6, I saw two bright lights, 11 o'clock, seem to back over to the right and then climb away at speed, at least from our perspective.
Okay, we're passing that on now, thank you.
Speedbird 9-4, Shannon.
9-4, good.
Okay, just so you know that other aircraft in the air have also reported the same thing, so we're going to have a look and see.
The speed is astronomical. It's like Mach 2 or something.
Roger. Okay, thank you.
So, Chris, I love hearing those things. We hear them sometimes here in North America, and it's just fascinating when you hear the live recording of people seeing UFOs. But you've looked into this one a bit. I wonder if you could talk about it.
Yeah, it's probably one of the most well-reported recent cases that involve. Although it was Irish air traffic control Shannon they were talking to there. So it's technically an Irish case, even though none of the aircraft are Irish. I think it was a BA, a Norwegian, and Virgin aircraft that were talking there. I find it fascinating. That is a major incident. Okay, and no doubt about it. We've three professional crews who are observing anomalies, for the want of a better word, Mike. Okay, and that was investigated by the Irish Aviation Authority. Now, the body that investigates on behalf of them is the Air Accident and Investigation Unit. Well, I reached out to them and asked for a copied report because they are bound by FOI, and they said, pretty funny, they replied via email saying, oh, we won't bother an FOI, Chris. I'm just telling you, we did not investigate it. And I'm going, well, that's unusual. I said, so I replied and said, well, okay, thank you very much. However, my FOI still applies. So eventually they got back to me and said they did not investigate it. Where my understanding was they were legally bound to investigate the air accident investigation. So anyway, I did a follow-up with the Irish Aviation Authority to see if they would give me a copy of the report. And basically, they blanked me. They did not want to know. The Irish Aviation Authority, you know, there has been changes in recent months for the structure in Ireland for the Irish Aviation Authority. So it has changed slightly in the last few months. So they were not, I suppose, a state body. They were semi-state, which meant they were not bound by the Irish, I think it's 2014, FOI legislation. So the fact they were sort of semi-state meant they weren't bound for it. I made an argument that this is in the public interest. We're not looking for a copy. This is not McDonald's. We don't want to know your secret sauce. We want to know this is in the public interest that this case is because it's reported. So that got refused. So I did a little bit of thinking, and this could be interesting for anybody in the EU. There's a thing called an AIE, which is Access to Information on the Environment. And it's similar to an FOI. However, private corporations and companies are bound by an AIE. So I made an AIE to the Irish Aviation Authority, and I made a point. we don't know what these pilots saw. However, there's a reasonable chance that this could have been space junk. That was mentioned in a few newspapers. So I made an argument that this could have been space junk. Space junk is a potential, I suppose, ecological hazard, environmental hazard. So if that hits the ground, it could be detrimental to everything. So I made a case that this could be, I suppose, detrimental to the environment. They ignore me. So I then took the case up with the Office of the Information Commissioner. That's a state body that oversees FOI's Act. They looked into it, they sided with me, and they've instructed your aviation authority to release the investigation report on that incident. So that'll be fascinating. I hope to get that soon, which I will share with you. So that's a bit of a result for the small people, that we can actually get results. There was an article, I think it was in the Irish Independent, by, I think the journalist was Alison Bray, and she was told by, they would not give her a copied report. They told her, I believe, it was confidential or classified. So I don't know why that could be classified as confidential. So hopefully I'll get my hands on that report soon, Mike.
It's amazing that originally they said, oh yeah, we didn't investigate that. That seems like so ludicrous because, you know, we didn't, what? Like, it's like they don't care. Yes. Like, it's so often you hear that, but I always feel the opposite is true, that they really cared about it and that it was really investigated. But for whatever reason, they don't want to tell you.
I remember the language there was one of the pilots said it pulls outside and then veered, these objects did. So, you know, that's interesting. You know, and at the altitude the aircraft would have been, I don't know, would it be maybe, I'm going to guess 35,000 feet, okay? Things will bounce off the atmosphere, but it'll be way above that. You know, and anything else coming would probably burn up before it gets to that altitude. So it's interesting that they did not release the report, but hopefully I'll get my hands on that fairly soonish, Mike, and I will, of course, look through that and share it with you, my friend.
Before we wrap this up, I just want to mention that I'm going to put a link to all of Chris's organizations in my show notes. And I just want to thank Chris so much for what my listeners haven't seen is you are a big time FOIA guy, Freedom of Information, and you have so much more to share. Now, the one note I will make is recently Apple Podcasts has started translating all podcasts that are on there. So I'm just excited to hear what the AI robot makes of what you're saying. I think the AI robot is going to go, and then Chris said, ah, to hell with it.
Okay.
I'm just kidding, Chris. But
okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been a lot of interesting information and a lot of stuff I've never known before. And definitely we'll have you on again.
Mike, thank you very much. It has really been a pleasure. It's the first time I've done an interview, the first time I've spoke on a podcast or anything, because I'm very much behind the scenes. I was a little bit apprehensive. However, I always go with my gut feeling. And when we spoke a few weeks ago, I said to myself, this Mike's a good guy. And interesting, my father passed away and I was quite young. And his mark of whether somebody was a good guy was, would you sit down and have a pint with him, Chris? And I would sit down and have a pint with you any day, Mike. It's been a pleasure. And talk soon, my friend.
Okay, so the next time I'm in Ireland, which will be my first time in Ireland, I'll hold you to that.
You better believe it. I'm going to. I spoke about Carl Nally and Dermot Butler, and they're two. I can't praise those guys enough. People have got to check out their work. And I'll meet Carl and Dermot the odd time for pint, and we will chat about stuff and so forth. And I think for anybody who knows people from Dublin will appreciate this. Carl has, you may have to put a few beeps in here, and I'd love to hear what AI makes of this. Carl will turn and say, Chris, they're effing UFOs. Don't give me any of that UAP. Beep. So that's Carl. He's just an incredible guy. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. And you mind yourself, and I'm sure we'll be in touch. Thank you so much, Mike, and God bless.
Here are the Canadian civil aviation anomalies for the week of April 1st through April 5th, 2024. On April 2nd, an Air Canada Airbus A320 flying from Edmonton, Alberta to Vancouver, British Columbia at FL340 reported hearing a strong but intermittent emergency locator transmitter for approximately 1 minute. The Joint Rescue Coordination Centre Victoria was advised. Reported on April 3rd, a Keewatin Air Beach B200 flying from Rankin Inlet, Nunavut, experienced a depressurization 100 nautical miles northwest of Rankin Inlet. According to Edmonton Area Control Center, the aircraft transmitted a 7700 squawk code and made a rapid descent to FL100. When the crew checked in with YRT Flight Service Station, the crew advised they were no longer in emergency status and declined assistance. The aircraft landed safely at 0649 Zulu time. On April 4th, an aviation incident report number 18561 was filed. A member of the public reported two separate clusters of moving lights over Auburn Bay, Calgary. The individual reported there were 8 lights per cluster, and they were moving side to side and across each other. There was no impact on operations, and all flights proceeded to their destinations without further incident.
Well, that's our podcast for this week, and I wonder if you can do me a favor for everyone that's still here listening at the end of the show. If you can leave a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to UFO Talker, because that definitely helps with our algorithm, with getting the show bumped up higher and higher so more and more people can see it. And of course, we just like reading the good reviews as well, I have to admit. So, and until next time, this is Michael Ryan. Keep watching the skies.
You have been listening to the UFO Talker. If you have any questions or comments on this episode, you can email us at ufotalker@bell.net or visit our website at ufotalker.ca. You can support UFO Talker by using the Buy Me a Coffee app with links on our website and in the show notes. We appreciate every listener. Thank you for your support. This has been a Michael Ryan production.
30, that's a wrap.